Welcome back to Research Talk. My name is Paola Marchionni. I'm Head of Engagement, Content and Discovery at JISC. And over the next six episodes, my colleague Peter Finley and I will be taking over Research Talk to bring you Is AI for Me? Perspectives from the Humanities. This mini-series will explore what it means to engage with artificial intelligence in the context of the humanities. In this episode, I am joined by Jane Winters, Professor of Digital Humanities and Director of the Digital Humanities Research Hub at the School of Advanced Study, University of London. But before we start, Jane, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your research interests?
Hi, Paola. Thank you very much for that introduction. As you mentioned, I'm based at the School of Advanced Study in the University of London, and we're funded as an institution to promote and facilitate humanities research across the UK. And an important strand of that is digital research and scholarship, and helping people to engage with new technologies and artificial intelligence is key to some of that work. My own research, I'm a historian. I started out working with 13th century materials, but have moved quite a long way from that these days and are generally working with born digital archives. So the archived web, social media, and other types of digital cultural heritage. And have been involved in a number of projects that are trying to explore these large data sets, make connections between them, and open them up for historical research.
Thank you, Jane. So you mentioned you trained as a historian. So the first thing that comes to my mind is that historians usually talk about sources, primary sources, secondary sources. But in the digital world, in the digital context, we talk about big data, data sets. So how does that sound for a historian? How do you reconcile that?
I think it's fair to say that that's a big shift in thinking for historians. And that change of language, it seems something quite simple, but it does affect the way people think about the material that they're working with. And I think it's talking about the processes of turning source materials and text into data, that datafication, which will help people to use them in different ways. But ultimately, they are data is still a source. And I know the archived web that I work with, I quite often describe it as a new kind of primary source, because that makes it an accessible and recognisable thing for people who've been trained in source criticism. And I think a lot of the skills that historians develop around source criticism are equally applicable to working with data sets as to working with 13th century manuscripts that hadn't been digitized, as my research started out with. So it is a bit of a shift and a different way of thinking, but it's really starting to become more common, I think, in the historiography and the discussion. And teasing apart those differences and connections is a really interesting area of research in itself.
Yeah, so I just wanted to come on to that. In a previous podcast that we did with James Baker, he mentioned the complexity of dealing with web archives and some of the articles or lessons that the programming historians has published on the subject talk about that. And of course, web archives and national web domains are crucial in your research. So can you tell us a little bit about what is a web archive or a national web domain? What kind of data is this? How do you use it? And what does it look like?
Yes, it was wonderful to hear that example of the programming historian engaging with web archives. It was a student at the School of Advanced Study, Kayo Mello, who's actually been involved in the production of some of that material. So it's great to start opening up this really, really complex and challenging source. I think most people, or many people, will be familiar with the Internet Archive's Wayback Machine as a way of accessing the historical web. And if they have tried to use that for any kind of research, they'll realise the sort of patchiness of it. There's a lot that's missing. There's uneven coverage. It fluctuates between different years, different points in the year, and so on. People will be less familiar, though, with two fantastic historical resources, sources, primary sources, and data sets in the UK, the UK Web Archive at the British Library and the UK Government Web Archive at the National Archives of the UK. And those two institutions are engaged in this huge work of archiving the .uk web domain. So any website that ends with .uk and some other combinations as well are in these data sets. At the British Library, they aim to be as comprehensive as possible. So there's an annual crawl of that whole web domain to scoop up as much material as possible. And the National Archives has a remit to get government data from the web. These are really huge data sets, a very daunting challenge, and in many cases beyond the computational power that most humanities researchers have access to. Just before this conversation, I was checking, and the 2019 domain crawl that the British Library did generated 170 terabytes of data. So that really is starting to be proper big data for people to work with. It's really complex. It's multimedia. It covers all aspects of life. We have newspapers in there, government records, personal blog posts, there's elements of social media, video. All of this material is scooped up into the web archive. And it's very difficult to navigate because it's so huge. And we don't even really know in any detail what's in there. Keyword search is not hugely helpful as a mode of access. It's what we've all become accustomed to when we're working with larger data sets, because any keyword search is likely to generate hundreds of thousands of results. So you're faced immediately with this challenge as a researcher of how can I do an effective distant reading of this resource, or how can I narrow it down to do a close reading and find the things that I'm really engaged with. So there's a lot of work and research just to discover the shape of that collection and where the most effective interventions can be made by researchers. And I think because of that scale, it's really interesting that metadata has become an object of study in this instance. If the content is too huge, then looking at the metadata first as a way of understanding it and engaging with it is a really interesting area of analysis. We're lucky enough to have something called CDX files for web archives, which summarize the content of an archived web document so you can get a sense of what's in it without having to look at the document itself. Ian Milligan has described them as the equivalent of finding aids, which any researcher will be familiar with from going into an archive. They're essentially an index to the content. And there are other large data sets. Some of this metadata would be too large for me to work with on my own laptop. It's again, huge. We're talking huge scale. And there are indexes of sites that link to each other. So you can, for example, trace the shape of government online by looking at how the departments reference each other. Lists of all of the sites that have been crawled, file formats, that kind of thing. So you can learn a lot about the history and shape of the UK web just from looking at the metadata before you even get into the content itself. And like so much humanities data, it is really messy because it's about people and we're messy and we generate mess and complexity around us. And that is the record of human history. And some of that messiness also comes out of the collecting processes. So there are a huge number of duplicates. There are partial crawls, missing data, and all of that needs to be unpicked and explored. But again, historians are very used to missing information. A medievalist will know that surviving documents are only a very partial record of the period that they're studying, the things that we happen to still have. And that's true with digital archives as well. And I think a final layer of complexity here is that these are also really living archives. Material drifts in and out of the Internet Archive, for example. There might be a takedown notice or an instruction not to crawl the website, and then that will disappear from the public archive. Material gets added. The two big web archives in the UK have been a sort of patchwork archives, materials added from other sources as the technology has improved and so on. So it's a really, really challenging, interesting landscape, quite difficult to get started. And you do really need to have an understanding of the tools available and the ways in which artificial intelligence can help you to start navigating that landscape.
Yes, that's exactly what I wanted to come on to next. Because given the messiness and the complexity and diversity of this data, in what way can AI be useful? When is it useful and when is it not? Do you have some examples for us?
It's a really interesting question because I think there's so much discussion around artificial intelligence that it's sort of something that's immediately reached for. This is bound to be able to help with this complex problem that I'm struggling to get to grips with. I think my starting point and the starting point for most humanities researchers is that it starts with understanding the data and the context of its creation. When, where, how, by and for whom it was created. That's really challenging to get to with the large scale data that some of us are working with and everyone will increasingly be working with, especially where it's been generated automatically. The automatic harvesting of data that doesn't have a human decision-making process there. So understanding collections in order to know the best approaches are really difficult. Colleagues at Living with Machines, which is a fantastic project at the British Library, have talked about the necessity of understanding the contours of the data before you get started. Otherwise, you're likely to just reach for the nearest digital tool or the one that you're most familiar with, and it may not be the most appropriate one to use. There are various mechanisms for trying to get to this contour of the data. Knowledge graphs can be really useful. So that's a network of entities, but also the relationships between them, which gives you a kind of macro level view of the data and the collections. And named entity recognition there, the automatic identification of people, places, organizations, objects, can really provide insights and enable that effective distant reading that can be so useful as a starting point of the research process. It can help with deduplication, with automatic linkage, identifying that that John Smith is the same person as the John Smith mentioned somewhere else or isn't, so that you can really securely locate individuals and places in this data. To a degree, you can never do that completely automatically. That's when the human intervention needs to come in, and human expertise augments what you can do with artificial intelligence. I was involved with a great project which was led by John Stack at the Science Museum in London called Heritage Connector, which was looking at producing a knowledge graph of the collections at the Science Museum, but also the Victoria and Albert Museum, and then linking that to Wikidata and ongoing linkage that's enabled when you can do that kind of work. And it really allowed different kinds of visualization of the collections, different ways of exploring it. At a hackathon, some demonstrators were produced. One, for example, presented the knowledge graph as a constellation that you could navigate through in a spaceship in a kind of gamification of the collections. And you came across these interesting clusters of objects and people and connections. So you can open up collections in playful ways, as well as enabling really innovative research. In terms of when it's less useful, I think a lot of that depends on what you want to do with the data that you've got. But I have yet really to see a convincing example of the application of sentiment analysis for historical research. It always sounds like it's going to be really interesting. And the project I was involved with, one of the first to look at the UK Web Archive, it was called BUDA, Big UK Domain Data for the Arts and Humanities. We got together a group of researchers who'd never worked with the web before and started to talk through what would they like to find in this web archive. And everybody got terribly excited about sentiment analysis. It was the sort of headline attractive thing. And then when we started to apply it, and it just flattened things out when you were dealing with large texts, it didn't really tell you anything terribly useful. We decided quite quickly that was not something we wanted to include in the suite of tools that we were developing. It wasn't a priority. So I would love to see that becoming more sophisticated and useful for historical research, but I don't think it's there yet in my experience anyway. I'm sure someone else will have found an enormously interesting use for it.
No, but that's really interesting to see. It's always really about the use cases and what your research questions are, and matching that with the best approach. Now, as you were saying, there's still a huge amount of human intervention that needs to be a part of this whole process, even if we use AI approaches. So data preparation, you were talking about how important it is to look at your data, to find out and to understand the data. So what are the steps that you would go through in terms of preparing data for processing and being used in AI?
I think the first thing that I would say is that there's a real need for data preparation to be made more visible. So I'm really glad that you asked that question, Paola. When, as humanities researchers, we write about computational work, there's a tendency to elide a lot of that data preparation and skip to the bit where you can start doing the research and you've got your interesting, beautifully prepared data set to work with. And I really think we need not just to focus on the outputs, but to be much more transparent and open about the processes and the challenges and the compromises of data preparation, because there's no such thing as a perfect data set. There have always had to be decisions and compromises along the way. The preparation that you need to do, again, really depends on the questions that you want to ask and the tools that you want to use. And sometimes the preparation will help you decide also which tools you want to use too. How tractable is the data that you're working with? What can you get from it? But generally, as I mentioned earlier, it's about trying to turn text into data. And there are a number of steps. I'm talking about textual data here, because I don't work with multimedia material centrally anyway. So there'll be other processes for people working with different kinds of data. But there are things like tokenization, turning that original sequence of characters into words or word-like units so that you can do things like named entity recognition. Depending on what you want to do, you might want to turn everything to lowercase, remove punctuation, get rid of stop words that you don't want appearing in your analysis, things like and the and so on. For web archives, it might be that stripping out of duplicates so that you can analyze trends over time without that being distorted by having 400 captures of the same page, which happens to mention a particular term a lot, so it gives it too much prominence, or extracting particular file formats. I'm always really struck now, though, by a wonderful quote from Catherine D'Ignazio and Lauren Klein's brilliant book, Data Feminism, where they talk about these processes and say that the process of cleaning and tidying data can be a destructive rather than constructive, that you are throwing things away, and it enables the research that you're doing, but being conscious of what you are excluding, and that might not be what someone else would choose to clean out of that data, is really interesting and important, and to bear in mind when we're thinking through and describing our processes for other people. And I also just wanted to mention that it's much easier to do that work if you're working with English language sources. The available tools for non-English language materials are improving enormously, but there's still a huge disparity between what's available to people working with English language sources. A student at School of Advanced Study, Kaya Mello, did really fantastic research looking at the discussion of the legacies of the London and Rio Olympics in Brazilian and UK newspapers. And what he was able to do with the English language text was so much easier than when he was trying to work with Brazilian Portuguese. And he did a really great comparison of what's possible to do when you're working with multilingual sources and on multilingual projects. So that's an area that I really hope will improve, and that artificial intelligence will start to work effectively and ethically with languages other than English.
Well, talking about ethic, I was thinking about the FAIR principles, so findability, accessibility, interoperability, and reuse. And I was wondering what the issues might be with this kind of data sets, so the data that we use for training, the output data, in relation to the FAIR principles.
It's important that we start by acknowledging that all data is biased. There are often multiple intersecting and interacting layers of bias, and trying to search for data that isn't biased in any way is going to be a long and probably quite pointless journey. That there are always biases in there. So it's how do we best represent those and document what we're doing, that recording of the processes as well as the outputs that I was describing earlier. There is a general lack of transparency, I think. There are numerous reasons for that. Some of it is because the information is produced by commercial entities who have sensitive intellectual property, so they don't want to reveal everything that's gone into the preparation of data and the training of tools. Sometimes it's a lack of funding in university-based projects. Documentation is quite often something that gets left towards the end of a project, rather than something that's embedded throughout. And that investment in doing that effective documentation and making sure that your data is not just open, but it is also fair, will benefit everybody enormously and really encourage that reuse of data that we all want to see, rather than everybody creating new data sets from scratch all the time. And if you don't have confidence in how something has been created, you'll be very reluctant to use it, because you wouldn't have trust in any claims that you would make on that basis. So it's really critical to that reuse and the interoperability around proper description and annotation as well. There are different levels of description, I think, for the huge web archives that I've been talking about. The general parameters are really well documented. The cultural heritage institutions that run these enormous crawls are very, very open about what's going on, how many sites are included, the parameters of the search and so on. But the history of the creation of the individual websites within that isn't visible. So there are these different layers of documentation and description, and some of them are more possible than others. In a project I'm working on at the moment, which is again led by the Science Museum, we've been using data sheets for data sets, which many people will be familiar with, as a way of thinking through these processes and recording the decision making that goes along as the data is cleaned. And that, I think, is going to be a wonderful resource for the project. I hope will make the data much more usable at the end of the project, but also helps us as a group of researchers to think through what we're doing and try to align our practices and exchange knowledge between everybody on the team who's bringing their different understandings to that project. And I think it's also the growing awareness of the care as well as FAIR principles. So that's the collective benefit, authority to control, responsibility and ethics, and bringing that in as well as some of the technical standards around documentation and sharing, and just generally thinking a lot more about what we do with our data and what someone else might want to do with it, and making sure that we don't close off possibilities because we haven't documented things effectively, and that we know we can trust the data that we're using. And I think that is a real challenge around some of the commercial data sets and tools trained on data sets where there's lack of clarity about how they've been put together is a real problem. And I think a challenge for funding bodies perhaps might be to give funding to projects that are coming to an end, when often members of the team are leaving because they've got fixed term contracts and they need to find employment somewhere else. A period of reflection and documentation and preparation to publish really robust, sustainable data at the end of a project, I think would be a great investment and would encourage much better practice across the sector.
That's a great suggestion about the importance of documentation. So I was wondering, how easy is it or not, aside from documentation, but to access the data in the first place in the right format that you need to support computational analysis, whether they are AI techniques or other type of techniques?
I think the short answer to that is that it's not easy at all. It is one of the really big challenges, and humanities researchers generally don't own their data. They are working with somebody else's data, whether that is social media data or cultural heritage digitized material. So there are always these problems, and it links on to that documentation question, as you said. I've already talked about the data that's locked away by commercial companies. I think that's partly, we need to reflect on that as a society about treating commercial entities as de facto archives when that isn't their purpose. Think about the sustainability of personal data that's owned by these companies, and who's responsible for keeping that and making it available. And terms and conditions of service can change overnight, as we have seen relatively recently with Twitter, for example. So that's a problem. Platform terms of use can be really ambiguous. They're often aimed at developers rather than researchers. So trying to tease apart what you're allowed to do and what you're not is really difficult. There's a lack of clarity over copyright and IP across the board, I think, even where institutions are very well intentioned, where data has been collected over time and elements of it are ambiguous, or there might be personal information in there but we're not sure, then there tends to be a default to the most risk-averse position, which reduces sharing and access. With the Web Archive as a particular challenge, the extension of legal deposit legislation that has enabled its collection, which is wonderful, also prevents computational access and effective exploitation, because you're not allowed to download data. You have to go to a library reading room and browse archived websites on a terminal. So you can only do qualitative research of that data. And that's why the metadata has become so important. What can be achieved when there's just open data, clear statements of access and so on, is visible in something like the availability of historical Hansard in the UK, which is digitized, open XML. Anyone can download it under an open government license. And there have been so many great projects that have used that data in fascinating ways, linked open data projects, changes in terminology over time, looking at changes in the gender balance in Parliament and what that might do to language and the things that are discussed. Really fantastic issues that could not have been considered without the availability and the ready availability of that open data. In some ways, it has led to a renewed interest in parliamentary history and looking at it as a cultural, social, economic history source. But it would be fantastic if that were possible with other large data sets as well. But I understand the risk aversion in cultural heritage institutions. They have a duty of care as well. So these are difficult things to navigate. But I think intervention and advice around copyright and legal questions like that would be a huge benefit to most humanities researchers. It's an area that there's very little bespoke advice available, I think, and it often needs to be bespoke because each data set will have a different context of production.
Thank you. That's really important. And it's really an issue about what data is available to researchers is probably the data that gets more used. If it's available openly, it's just easy to use. But just to pick on something that you mentioned earlier on about choosing the approaches and the tools to use, how does a researcher go about deciding what is the right approach, what is the right technique? And indeed, if AI is the right thing or any kind of techniques that are artificial intelligence techniques.
I feel like I'm answering every question by saying it's really challenging. It is really challenging that there are so many tools around, the majority of which do something very well, and it's hard to distinguish between them and which one you should be using. There's also, I think, because of funding of innovation and needing to produce new tools all the time, there's a certain tendency to reinvent the wheel. So a single really good tool doesn't become dominant, and there'd be issues around that, of course, as well. But you end up with multiple tools that do the same thing in subtly different ways, and that makes this decision-making process really hard. The first thing that I would say is just to talk to specialists in your institution if you're lucky enough to have them. Librarians and other information professionals are, you know, a wonderful and underused resource in most universities, for example. If you're lucky enough to have research computing support in your institution, that's a fantastic source of information that will help you with making these decisions. Because making the wrong decision at the start of a project and then getting locked into something that turns out not to be appropriate can have really, you know, difficult effects on a project further on. It's very tempting to stick with a tool that you know rather than invest time in learning a new one, because everybody's busy, and if you're not sure whether something's going to be the right tool, do you really want to spend a lot of time learning it only to discover that it isn't? But that, I think, leads to things like Excel, which is really for numerical analysis, being used for textual analysis in ways that can introduce errors and cause problems when there might be more effective things out there to use. There are wonderful resources to help you. You talked about the Programming Historian already, the Software Carpentry suite of tools to help people work through, decide what's going to help them and how to learn and get started. But I don't think there's a shortcut, really. It is about consultation, looking at other kinds of projects, but also being very clear about what it is that you want to do, unless you've got scope for proper experimentation in your project. I would say don't use AI for the sake of it. You know, there is this temptation. Everybody's talking about it at the moment. There's been this breakthrough around things like ChatGPT. So it's in people's minds. But there are some things that, for the moment anyway, will always be done better by humans. So it's not going to be a fix-all. A lot of that data cleaning that we were talking about at the start of this conversation still needs a lot of human intervention, even if you can automate it to an extent. And there are decisions around that kind of tipping point where your investment in learning a tool might take longer than actually just doing it in a relatively longhand way. Can you actually close read your data? If you can, and having a really deep understanding of it through that close reading is going to make your research more effective, then why use artificial intelligence when you don't need to? But there will be a point at which you can't close read, and then you do need to start thinking about alternative approaches. So it's a kind of mix and match combination. As I said, artificial intelligence won't do everything for you. It would be slightly depressing if it did, if there wasn't a role for the researcher to apply their expertise in there as well. But get as much advice and consultation as possible. And if there isn't, I know smaller institutions, there often isn't the capacity. There are other national and international resources, as like the Programming Historian, that can help.
Thank you. So it's very much a very challenging landscape, as you kept on saying. So moving on to something slightly different but related, you're also the founding member of the recently established UK Ireland Digital Humanities Association. Can you tell us a little bit about the association and why it was set up?
I'll start by saying I'm one of the founding members. We're a collective, so it's a lovely, I hope, equal organisation that we're looking to expand. The association was launched last summer. We'd had some funding from the Arts and Humanities Research Council in the UK and the Irish Research Council to explore how we would go about setting up an association and what it might do. And then that has led to this, to a launch with a 3-year roadmap to full establishment. And the aim of the association is to build capacity for research and teaching in digital humanities across the UK and Ireland, to establish and sustain effective connections with sectors outside higher education, the GLAM institutions, bodies like JISC, Research Libraries UK, who are all invested in this digital scholarship space, and to create new pathways for collaboration, I think large collaborative projects. are something that is increasingly of interest to more people and accessible to more people too. And we hope to support that activity. It builds on a lot of existing partnerships, but it's also bringing together new stakeholders as well to consider questions around sustainability, inclusivity, training, advocacy, and career progression, among lots of other questions. And we've actually just launched 5 community interest groups where we put out a call for the various digital scholarship communities in the region to tell us what they were interested in looking at. A wonderful range of subjects, from safeguarding of researchers dealing with traumatic data to environmental digital humanities practices. And that is something that connects quite closely to artificial intelligence, thinking about, you know, what it is that we're doing, how much energy we're using every time a request to generate an AI-produced image is made. So I think there'll be some really interesting work coming out of that. And career is a very important aspect of this as well, and skills development. And we've produced 2 reports already, one of which covers capacity building in DH with a focus on research software engineers. And the other one is looking at more generally careers in and from digital humanities. So not assuming that people will stay within the higher education sector, but can make contributions across the society.
That's great. And so you mentioned some of the activities. In terms of plans for the future, what are the plans of the association?
I think consultation and more consultation and then a bit more consultation. this is a really rapidly changing area, and we want to make sure that this new association really captures what's going on in the UK and Ireland and how best interventions, most effective interventions can be made. I've mentioned careers already, but we're going to be publishing a guide to career pathways as part of that roadmap. We've been looking at the identification and alignment of different sectors that are engaged in digital humanities and digital humanities related work, and how conversations there can be improved. There's a lot of advocacy, advocating for good practice wherever that exists. So again, casting the net very broadly for anyone who's doing really good work in this area. And as I mentioned, working with other professional bodies and funders to unpick these knotty problems and opportunities. They're not just challenges. And making sure that investment is as effective as it can be in this area to really improve capacity, develop skills and support researchers doing what they want to do.
Excellent. You mentioned working with other stakeholders and partners. In what way do you think JISC can help?
I think there are lots of ways in which JISC can help and has already helped, actually. Support and interest in the association was fantastic. But I think there's a role for JISC just to pick their way through, to help people pick their way through, not just a complex landscape, but one that's changing so rapidly. As an individual, it's really easy for your knowledge to become out of date, if not quite overnight, not far off it. There are really big shifts in what's going on. An organisation like JISC is able to survey the field, see what's going on, help people to understand where their efforts might best be turned, for example. And I think there could be a really important convening and brokering role as well. JISC is so well connected to different sectors, particularly the galleries, libraries, archives and museums sector, and helping universities, librarians and information professionals to connect in those ways that we were talking about could be really, really valuable. Helping people through those decision-making processes, providing resources. I hesitate to say toolkit because there are so many toolkits, but helping people to, you know, if I want to do this, who should I talk to? Where should I go? What tools are available? That mapping of what the resources that are out there for people. And again, that question of licensing and intellectual property that we talked about, I think there could be a really valuable piece of work there in skilling researchers to ask the right questions, to know when they can push at the limits of this and when they shouldn't, and you know, really support around that kind of work.
That's really useful feedback. Jane, as we come to an end of our conversation, do you have any thoughts or reflections from a digital history point of view in terms of the future and digital history and AI?
That's another really great question. And obviously, this is just my perspective, and other people, if you ask 10 historians, you'll get 11 different perspectives. So some events that I've been at recently, there's been a really interesting and new for me emphasis on slowing things down and pausing to think through the consequences of what we're doing in this area. I was at an Archives in the Environment workshop at the National Archives earlier this week, and this idea of just slowing it down, thinking about the environmental consequences of what we're doing, making sure that those are questions worth asking before we ask them. And I think there's this tendency, again, everything's moving at such breakneck speed, and I talked about getting left behind, but perhaps we actually shouldn't be scrambling to keep up all the time, but should really take time to think through the consequences of using artificial intelligence in historical research and other research as well. There's a growing emphasis for me on the personal responsibilities of researchers to pursue ethical practice. Most institutions have got really good ethics boards and approval and so on, but what do I, as a researcher, feel comfortable with? Am I looking after the people whose data I am working with, the people who are mentioned in my data, even when that's, 200 years old, for example? What are the consequences of linking at scale that might expose named entities of all kinds in data to different kinds of exploration and be very exposing? So really getting frameworks in place that help people make really ethical, responsible choices around that. I've already mentioned the need for much better artificial intelligence for multilingual research. That, I think, is a really key area and very strongly connected to equity as well. Right at the very start, talked about source criticism, and I think that's much more important than ever. And I don't think historians should be shy about that, that they bring that expertise to the table. That's what we do. It's one of our kind of superpowers, is thinking about how things have been created and how they survived. So, and I really think that's an important conversation to be had around data increasingly, and knowing the limitations of that. I think there are wonderful opportunities for co-production of historical knowledge with large-scale data when we're bringing in the human expertise and human understandings and perspectives to work alongside artificial intelligence. And I think that working with AI and helping to shape its direction is really significant, that it's not, as I said, a tool that will do everything. You just set a tool running and, there you go, you get the results at the end. It's not something to be scared of necessarily, I don't think. It's something to be treated with caution, but ultimately it is a tool to help us research more effectively and get greater insights into the human condition over the past and present, and potentially how things might change in the future as well.
Thank you very much, Jane. So a note of caution, and we come to the end of the podcast. Thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure speaking to you.
Thank you, Paola, for such fantastic questions.